Welcome to our resumed Employment Law 101 webinar series. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Peter. I'm a partner with a firm called NPM Legal. We're a specialist employment and business immigration practice based in the south of England, but we work with businesses that are all over the world. They have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK, and that's of course where we come in and help them. I am delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning, everybody. Nice to be back.
We've had our little winter hiatus, haven't we? And we're now back and in the hot seat, and feels good to be going again, actually.
Yeah, I love the fact you call it a winter break. Makes me feel like I might be a professional footballer.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. Sadly, no sunshine and trips to somewhere warm to recuperate. I'm stuck in flooded,
no,
rain, wet, cold southern England.
Yeah.
For those of you that joined us before Christmas, the theme of our Employment Law 101 Series 3 is around the cost of living. Today, we wanted to talk about a couple of things, or one thing in particular that impacts on that in terms of the national living wage, we'll get onto that shortly. But there's been quite a few updates in the employment law space, and there's absolutely loads coming down the track for 2024. So I think we're going to have some interesting sessions before we close out in the spring on this particular series. For those of you that haven't joined us before, these sessions are recorded, so you can dip into them later on our website. Of course, we put the audio as a podcast onto Spotify and Amazon Music. So if you want to go back, we're probably up to about 37, 38 episodes, I think now. So if you want to go back and just have a look at things like impact of cost of living, gender pay gap reporting, flexible working, home working, redundancy, dismissing employees fairly, all of that jazz, we've totally got it covered. So just search for Employment Law 101 on Spotify. One other quick bit of housekeeping to mention is, please, by all means, use the chat function down at the bottom. If you have a question for us, though, please use the Q&A function. We absolutely love questions, so please fire away. We'll try and pick them up as we go along. We're not going to open, I don't think we can actually, but we're not going to open up anybody's video or microphone, which I have seen on other webinars, which is a bit terrifying. And you can ask things on an anonymous basis as well. We won't identify you. So please do ask away and, you know, make the use of joining us live today. That being said, shall we get into the first topic, Adrienne, which I think is on national minimum wage, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Quite a lot going on in that space.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the big headline news is obviously that national minimum wage rates are jumping by quite a bit in April. I think you and I were with a client actually on the day of the budget announcement back in November, weren't we? And
yeah.
We, you know, there was a break in the session we were doing, and the news came out that it was jumping up by, I think it's just over £1 an hour. And we were talking to that specific client around how they factored in an estimated rate. And this was a lot more than a lot of people were actually anticipating, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it does make a significant impact on sort of the lower paid employees for sure.
Yeah, so basically, the current position is that the national living wage, which is the effectively see it as the top rate of national minimum wage. So the national living wage applies to everybody that's age 23 or over, and that's £10.42. And then beneath that top rate, you've basically got different bands, and those different bands vary according to age. And the lowest rate is £5.28 an hour currently, and that's for apprentices. Now, in April, the national living wage is actually going to apply to everyone who's 21 or over. Now, at the moment, there is something called a standard adult rate, and that's for people who are in that 21 to 23 band. Obviously, because of the qualification for national living wage is coming down in terms of age, that standard band is disappearing. So it's going to bring a lot more employees and workers into the range for the higher rate of pay. You're still going to have a development rate, which will be the next highest band, and that's currently £8.60. But you know, because of these changes, there's been quite a bit in the news about it, Adrienne, hasn't there?
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. From well, I mean, sort of like the cost of living crisis is putting the squeeze on everybody. You know, it's on employers and employees, and you know, we've already seen quite a lot of strikes over pay in the news. But obviously, the low Pay Commission was really keen to get in and start increasing the lower levels of pay. And, you know, certainly companies have reacted in different ways. I mean, we know from our own experiences that companies have had some fairly difficult conversations with unions, for example, where they're negotiating rates of pay, and they've had to work quite hard, haven't they, to reach agreement with the unions. And then this news came out and it almost watered down the sort of the pay increases that had been agreed, because obviously, you know, that with the basic level going up, that sort of narrows any potential gap above between that and what you know, what the what they're agreeing to pay their staff.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we know organizations that purposely pitch their wage levels, their salary levels, just above or with a certain margin above the national living wage, because they want to be seen as an employer of choice. They want to attract the best people. And I think the difficulty there is you've got quite a jump with the increase that's coming in April, really, to maintain, you know, your ability to say, hey, look how fantastic we are in terms of what we pay. It is going to be quite a material increase in terms of your staffing costs, isn't it, to maintain that?
Yeah, and then, you know, it's sort of following on from that, we've got the is it the Living Wage Foundation, I think it's called, which is an organization which is voluntary, and a number of employers, quite a lot of employers, sign up to that to say, well, look, okay, we know the national living wage is at this level, but the Living Wage Foundation gets employers to sign up to pay a living wage which is higher than the national living wage. And again, it's part of their part of the PR. Look what a good employer we are. We recognize we've got, you know, low pay workforces, but we will sign up to this foundation and we'll pay what's called the living wage. But in the news, there's been a lot of companies, haven't there, that have said that, you know, because of the cost of living crisis and because of, well, not necessarily the cost of living, but generally the squeeze on their costs and their profits, etc., they're no longer going to be in a position where they can offer to pay that that living wage, that voluntary living wage. I think something like 14,000 employers are signed up to it at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a significant number, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's like a massive number. And I think it's worth just talking about, there are a couple of different concepts out there, aren't there? You've got the real living wage, which is the voluntary.
Yes, that's what I meant to say.
Yeah, and yeah. I think, you know, that is, you know, what you've identified. It's a Living Wage Foundation scheme, and 14,000 employers are signed up for that. Within London, here in the southeast, you've got the London Living Wage as well, which again is set by a particular group with some oversight of that process. Now, the London Living Wage is also voluntary, and that I think is currently £13.15 per hour. So it's that gap is obviously getting eroded. And you know, what we've seen in terms of the wider economic climate and those businesses that are making some quite tough decisions at the moment is, I think, a split between those who are, you know, really investing in wage growth and kind of making a virtue out of it and saying, look, this is what we're going to do because we need these people. And other companies, and I'm thinking, for example, the Revolution Group, you know, the bar club chain operator, they announced recently that they're closing 8 of their least profitable locations. And when you look at the CEO's comments on why that is, he's saying, well, look, there's kind of two factors at play here. The first is the squeeze on younger people who come to our bars, and basically they've got less disposable income because of everything else that's happening. But also the national living wage is materially increasing this year, and we need to factor that in terms of profitability of the business. So there are some quite tough decisions there. But on the other side of things, you've got Lidl, who this week announced that they're investing, I think it's £39 million in wages. And, you know, they're basically saying, well, you know, this is what we're going to do in terms of our salary approach, notwithstanding, you know, all of these living wage increases that are coming through. I know one of the big ones that there was a lot of media around, it seems to be a lot of press around kind of anything they do, really, but in recent years around people for, you know, one reason or another, and that's BrewDog, right?
Yeah, no, I was reading about this. They've basically said they can't afford to pay workers the real living wage, which is the voluntary element. And I think that outside of London is £12 an hour. So, having been lauded by the employees as doing the right thing by them, they're now being accused of abandoning their principles. And as you say, they seem to hit the headlines on everything they do. But one of the things that struck me as being a an employee relations slash PR nightmare is that they went out to survey their staff to talk about what's important to them, and the top thing that was important to staff was maintaining this real living wage. But they've come out now and said that they can't afford it. Now, that's only for new staff, because obviously reducing pay for existing staff is going to be really difficult. But I think it is, they have said, it's basically due to the fact that costs have increased and profits have gone down. They just can't afford it.
No, absolutely.
And they're not the only ones, are they? So
No, Capita are coming out of the living wage scheme as well. So, maybe 13,999 employers who are signed up to that scheme. And you kind of think, well, an organization of the size of Capita, that's quite a significant decision. I would imagine they have a lot of employees who are above that pay rate anyway, but people at the bottom who are being squeezed are going to be potentially missing out. So, I think what's going to be interesting to see in terms of how this pans out is how the low pay commission respond to this, and will it actually achieve what they're talking about? Before we move on, I think one area that in recent years does come under examination is not tripping yourselves up on national minimum wage calculations, because obviously as employment lawyers, in terms of where we've been involved in that around the some of the more obscure provisions of the legislation that deals with national minimum wage. And I do remember a few years ago, or a couple of years ago, there was quite a few cases, especially of retailers, high street retailers, who were in trouble, publicly named and shamed by the government for underpaying national minimum wage. I think also in the restaurant industry as well. And often it was to do with staff uniform allowances. And in the restaurant industry, obviously in relation to maybe tips or overtime worked, and how that ultimately fed into calculating the hourly wage rate. So it is quite easy to get inadvertently unstuck, especially if you're just focusing on one headline hourly rate and not taking into account other things that are going on in terms of remuneration. So that's one watch out there, isn't it?
I mean, that was the weird one, wasn't it? I think it's, well, off the top of my head, I think Monsoon was one of them. And it was whether or not their sort of like uniform policy saying you must wear black trousers to work would indicate that the employees were then having to pay out for that out of their own money. And because it was a company mandated policy, it was then deemed that that would actually bring their rate below the hourly rate because they were having to fork out of their own money this type of uniform. And I say uniform in inverted commas because the argument from the companies, I think, a lot of the time was, well, most people would have black trousers in their wardrobe anyway. But getting off topic, I thought it was quite interesting at the time,
No, absolutely.
but definitely a pitfall.
Let's move on. Gender pay gap,
Gender care pay
here.
gap.
Well,
Yeah. So,
generally, it's the things on this, so.
Well, it's not quite on topic of our cost of living crisis, but kind of sort of. And I'll say up front, it's a controversial one. I'm sure you've all been reading about it in the news, and be quite interested to hear your views on this. But I think it's fair to say that a storm is starting to brew here. See what I did there? It's a link to BrewDog.
Yeah, very good.
Just saying. Yeah, just saying. Yeah. So, yeah, but I mean, look, it appears that somebody has uncovered that the Government Equalities Office has issued advice that firms should be encouraged to report pay based on the gender an employee identifies with, as opposed to the biological sex. And of course, this has led to many complaints from campaigners that this is just simply going to skew the exact issue that the gender pay gap reporting requirements were brought in to address, with that being the difference in pay between men and women based on their sex. With the offshoot of that, once you've identified the gender pay gap, you've then got to put in place steps to try and address it. I mean, the sort of like the transgender debate and things like whether the Equality Act is fit for purpose is massive. And this is just another example, I think, of where the confusion between the two terms, gender and sex, is just starting to reach out even more and more into what is it's a very, very difficult area. But, you know, I don't know where this is going to end up, but certainly I think the Equality Act, which we all know goes back to 2010, and certainly from my perspective, then seems to be quite modern, whether it's actually fit for purpose given the society we live in now. But that's a whole sort of philosophical debate. But, you know, the confusion around the terms is definitely going to be difficult. So I think Kemi Badenoch is going to weigh in on this and look into it. What that actually means, we don't know yet. But at the moment, I think a government spokesman has just said, well, employers are left to figure out how to do their reporting and it should be as simple as possible, which, you know, is a really easy and very vanilla statement to make, but actually I think creates quite a lot of difficulties. And bearing in mind the forthcoming deadline for submitting your gender pay gap reporting is March, it's something that employers need to think about, because I think it creates arguments and potential claims on several different groups of people. So it's going to grow legs. It's going to leave employers in a tough position. So if they report based on biological sex, you know, as many people would argue is in the spirit of what it's about, then they could face detriment claims from those who identify as female, and therefore their numbers should be included in the female gender pay gap. On the other hand, if they include in their reporting the pay based on identified gender, then that's going to lead to further complaints from women who feel that their rights are being eroded, which is, as we know, something that's hit the press an awful lot. So I'd be interested to see whether this is something that any of you guys have looked at, been involved with, have thought of. Any comments or any knowledge sharing, anonymously, of course, would be very welcome.
So you said any of you guys there, which is using gendered language, isn't it?
I shouldn't do that, should it's, I? No, but to be fair to me, I use guys for absolutely everything.
I mean, we do the same as well, but I remember producing a settlement agreement, I don't know, 18 months ago for someone we were working with. And I was, you know, politely and gently challenged on why the template document had, didn't have gender neutral pronouns in there, basically. And that particular organization wanted to use them, which is obviously their right. So that's what we produced. I think just generally on this topic, with the political discourse around it anyway, I think you're right, it is only going to grow more legs. I mean, there was a jibe at Prime Minister's questions yesterday from Rishi Sunak towards Keir Starmer. He said something along the lines of, well, Keir Starmer doesn't even know what a woman is. So, you know, that's the kind of the narrative at the moment, and, you know, question mark about the whole culture wars angle and what's been stoked and what are in people's interests to kind of inflame and debate. But putting that political stuff to one side, there's a lot of, I think, uncertainty and confusion for employers grappling on this. I mean, you know, I'll talk in a moment about the employment tribunal judgment that we had. I've just seen comments somebody's made saying, is it me or is the world going nuts? We've been doing this job long enough where now you see a kind of evolution in terms of attitudes and approach, right? I mean, compared with when I started practicing to what the environment is now around equality and diversity and equality and inclusion generally. I mean, the whole direction of travel of that personally, I think is a fantastic thing. But you're always going to have things on the margins and where there is disagreement. And I guess out of that disagreement, you get change. But in the meantime, you know, all of you that are working within organizations that are responsible for setting policy, setting rules, it's hard to know where the boundaries lie, isn't it?
I think it's extremely difficult, you know, and it's not just setting sort of like the paperwork and all the rest of it, but how do you give practical advice, a guidance to somebody? Because in essence, what you can say is we can give you the guidance, but we can't guarantee that people aren't going to kick off about it. Mm. I mean, you know, the current debate on trans rights versus women's rights is massive. in the same way that you've always had and have had quite a lot of cases on the clash between religious beliefs and sexual orientation, for example. It's two different sets of beliefs which create a clash. And it's incredibly difficult to try and navigate because which side of the fence do you come down on? And I think we were talking about this offline, saying one of the most important things to try and do is try not to end up in a position where you are taking sides and creating potentially a cultural environment where you can be accused of that. But it's not that easy because discrimination, harassment, that type of stuff, creating a hostile environment, a lot of it is can be quite very subjective.
Yeah,
And
absolutely.
it's when we've done harassment claims, it's a case of, well, it's remembering where that somebody can be offended by it. And ultimately, that's the subjective part of it. The objective test of it that comes in, which really you only get when it goes to tribunal, is whether a reasonable person could be offended. And at the moment, we don't really know where that sort of like that line's going to fall in this particular debate.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably quite a neat segue into the Employment Tribunal judgment that was widely reported earlier this week. So that was a claim by Professor Jo Phoenix. She brought a claim against the Open University. Professor Jo Phoenix has gender critical beliefs. She is a criminologist, I believe. I think part of a case was around a no platforming incident where she was due to give a lecture at Essex University, I think it was. Students threatened to barricade the venue and she wouldn't be permitted to speak. There then followed, I think, a public publication of a letter. Which the university were either responsible for or somehow in control of. And the tribunal found that the publication of that letter essentially led to a public pile-on of Professor Phoenix and a lot and lot of comments she received about her own views. Part of her claim was a constructive dismissal claim, and that centered around the publication of that letter and the steps that the university could have taken to essentially protect her. And that's to your point, Adrienne, I think actually around this concept of coming down on one side of the debate. I mean, obviously, there are going to be beliefs out there held by people which are completely contrary to normal public opinion, right? So they're like abhorrent beliefs. So, in relation
Extremism.
to, racism, for example. But equally, there are going to be beliefs out there that significant people may not agree with, but they are themselves capable of being protected by an open and tolerant society. And when you start looking at religion or belief and protection under the Equality Act and what's capable of being protection, we've seen all sorts of things that the tribunals have said, hey, look, we're able to give protected status to this. So ban on fox hunting was one, I think. Veganism, I think. There was a case involving somebody who had a firmly held belief in relation to climate change and refused to fly anywhere with work or on holiday. These are all things that are capable of protection. And I think what we're seeing in relation to these gender arguments is that there are a set of beliefs which are capable of being protected. And the elephant trap for employers to avoid falling into is coming down on the more popular, if I can put it that way, side of the debate or whatever they perceive that to be, to the exclusion of the other side of the debate in a way that unfairly treats or discriminates against that other party, right?
It's not that easy, though, is it?
It isn't. I mean, it's easy for me to say it and talk about it in conceptual terms today as we're discussing it.
I think the problem here is, like I said, with the sexual orientation versus the religious beliefs case, I think in essence it was you cannot condone one form of you can't discriminate against somebody, but equally you can't rely on your protected characteristic to justify discrimination of another characteristic. And in this situation here, it's more difficult than that because both sides are absolutely butting head to head, and it's incredibly difficult, but it's trying to maintain a balance, and that at the moment I think is the best that you can do, and accept that unfortunately there are going to be issues that are raised.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to our final topic today around working from home and another employment tribunal claim, which has given a bit
Another one, yeah.
of insight for us all,
Yeah.
advising companies on this issue. Before we talk about that, though, just as a reminder, please do check out Spotify or Amazon Music for our previous episodes. Have a listen. Please do rate us if you're able to through that, because it just really helps with our visibility. I put a post up on LinkedIn this morning as well, because what caught my eye is the Labour government last week, sorry, the Labour government, Freudian slip,
Ooh.
the Labour Party last week published essentially their agenda for change. I think they called it not a manifesto, a mission statement. That's it. And, Adrian, you remember before Christmas, you and I, we did one of these sessions. We were looking at what a change government might mean for employment rights in the UK. Again, there's an episode of that on Spotify. And the changes are pretty significant, right? In terms of
Yeah.
what coming online. I mean, really significant, really significant. And some of those changes are now in print. I mean, obviously not detail, but their commitment in terms of what will change if they do get voted in a general election, which is bound to happen at some point in 2024. So if you have a look on that LinkedIn post, I've linked through to that mission statement. And of course, you can listen to our thoughts on what's going to be happening there. But that's an ever-moving beast. So we'll keep you updated, and we'll probably do a sweep-up session in a few weeks' time just to bring up to date what we know about what's coming down the line there.
Yeah.
That said, working from home, which is a kind of a constant topic of source of information request to us, right? I can't tell you how many times I'm having these discussions with clients around what can we do to encourage people back into a work or office environment following a long, long period of home working. Just curious to know from you participants today, about home working. I know this isn't going to apply to all of your businesses, but I just put a poll up, which hopefully you can see. I'm just curious to know what kind of approach you're taking. So let me leave that running for a bit. But we've had an employment tribunal judgment, haven't we, involving the FCA?
Yes, we have. Now, I mean, look, I think probably everybody else read it yesterday as well, and that more and more companies are starting to say they want staff coming back. Bank of America was one that came out yesterday and said they want staff to be back in the office full time. They did say that it seems to be only for their US employees, but you know, if they start with the US, they're going to roll it out across the European entities, I'm sure. But yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that there's now a bit of a groundswell of employers starting to be concerned and starting to rethink their post-COVID plans for a variety of reasons. And this recent case against the FCA kind of lends support to, I think, where we are in terms of that movement. So, you know, post-COVID, everybody got really excited about home working and, you know, hybrid. And what does hybrid mean? Is it set in stone in the contract? But in this FCA case, they already had in place a hybrid working policy where, apart from the senior leaders, employees could work 60% remotely, with the remaining 40% being in the office. Senior leaders, I think, would be 50-50. Now, one senior manager, and interesting to note, she wasn't senior manager, so I'd probably call it middle management. She made a flexible working request to work fully remotely, and she was top performer. There was no issues, as I could see it from reading the case, around her performance. She did very, very well, but the FCA rejected her request. And as you all know, there's a number of statutory reasons why you can reject a flexible working request. And they went for a few of them, but mainly that it would have a detrimental impact on her performance. And one of the things they specifically highlighted, which I think is really critical and for me really important, is the fact that, you know, as a team leader, she had junior staff reporting to her. And one of the factors that I picked out was that if she was totally absent from the office, the FCA thought that that would really deprive the junior members of having access to her expertise and her leadership. And, you know, I'm quite a big believer in that juniors learn an awful lot by sitting next to people, that they can just pick up on things from hearing conversations, or essentially just being able to pop their head up and going, "What do you think about this?" or "How do I do this?" That
I
kind of
learned by
learning environment.
osmosis.
Yeah, absolutely, which I think is missing in a remote environment where it becomes a lot more formalized. So obviously went to tribunal. This lady's still employed, so she brought the claim while she was still employed, and the judge in the case pretty much said that technology is not that great when you're talking about rapid discussion that would occur in planning or strategic meetings or in training, which I thought was really interesting. So he rejected her claim and it failed. So the FCA's decision to reject her request was upheld. And I think that that's quite a key case in terms of people moving back into the direction of having people back into the office. Whether or not there's going to be an appeal, we just don't know. But that decision came out just before Christmas.
Yeah, I've put a link to the judgment in the chat, actually. So you should be able to click on that and bring up the PDF. I mean, if you're in a situation where you are trying to encourage people back to work and it gets to the point where it's really getting quite difficult, you know, and you need to flex your muscles a little bit, or, you know, indeed you are coping with flexible working applications that are coming through from employees, it's worth dipping into this judgment because it's got some really useful nuggets in terms of how to position it. Bear in mind, though, it is just first level decision. So employment tribunal decision, it won't bind other employment tribunals at all, but it is indicative of how the judiciary might view a similar sort of case. I mean, for me, I thought one of the useful aspects of the decision actually is a kind of reinforcement of this idea of how to approach flexible working applications. So be that an application to work from home or an application to vary working hours or patterns of working, for example. And I know just from conversations with clients, that can be a really, really knotty area sometimes. And I mean, I think the thing with COVID and working from home from, you know, when the pandemic kicked in 2020, which feels like a long time ago now, is it's been embedded. I mean, it's almost like we had such an advancement, such a big leap forward in terms of how we interact with colleagues and work as a business within a really, really short period of time. And I think organizations are still trying to find that balance. I know you and I have had discussions with clients where, you know, quite often it seems to be sales teams where there's a question around, we want this high performing environment, we want salespeople to be brought together. How can we really, really
drive
that? Yeah. Some of the judges' comments on this case, though, I mean, clearly he was very impressed by the witness who gave evidence for the FCA. And this person was obviously the decision maker in terms of the flexible working. He said that he found her to be an impressive witness. She gave clear and cogent evidence about her approach to the application and her decision making process. She genuinely considered the individual's merits as opposed to simply seeking to reinforce the attendance policy. And I think the takeaway there is look at every case on its own merits.
Yeah.
Don't just be tempted to kind of fall into line with whatever the company policy is and re-engineer it. Well, that's the policy. That's it. We don't really need to think too deeply about what you're telling us. Because that's not the way that you're going to be able to successfully defend challenges to those decisions.
It's like a lot of these things, though, isn't it? It demonstrates that it can be done, but you've got to have your evidence. You've got to have your strong business reasons. You've got to have evidence to back it up, all of which shows that you've probably thought about it. It's the same with any performance discussion, if you like. Don't just say you haven't met your targets. It's like, this is the target you haven't met. This is what you were expected to do, and this is how you fell short. So it's being really, really specific and looking at it on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm aware that we've kind of run over time, but one just little final nugget I thought I'd add on to that one is a practical point. The judge did actually award her a week's pay, and that was nothing to do with the success of our application, but that was essentially a penalty against the FCA because they took longer than the 3-month statutory period to deal with her complaint. Now, that failure can carry a maximum of 8 weeks, so it's a token award, but it's still a reminder that 3 months period during which time you're meant to make a decision is important and can expose you to an award.
Yeah. So don't fall foul of the procedural elements by focusing too much on the substantive decision-making process.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we're going to wrap things up there. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time for another update. So please do join us. If you want updates in the meantime, please do seek us out on LinkedIn because we do post pretty frequently as a company and as individuals on there. So always some useful nuggets. And as I've mentioned several times, please, please do check out podcasts because there's some really useful back information on there for you. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your week. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks' time.
Thanks very much, everyone.
Bye.